welcome to the Pocket Gamer Podcast, he says with a sense of victory, because it's episode number 400.
What?
The big four. Ooh.
Yeah.
That's probably episode 4,000, isn't it?
Maybe a couple, yeah.
Or 4 million. Yeah.
We're not going to make it to 4 million, I don't think. However solid the subscriber base is, I don't have it in me, guys. I can't do it.
Yeah, it'll probably be an assortment of noises by the time 4 million comes around. Just,
I'll definitely be dead at that point.
Well. I'm going to die. I'm going to make sure I'm buried with a little, you know how if you squeeze a fluffy toy, it says a little catchphrase?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll have one of those on top as a headstone, and you can just kick my headstone, and it'll go, games! Like that. And then that'll be my weekly contribution to the podcast so that it can carry on in my absence.
Yeah, sounds good. Right.
Probably just sums up my contribution thus far. Occasionally yelling games. The word games. Yep. That'll do. It's about as informative as I get. We'll not do anything super fancy for the episode, mainly because I'm about to get on a plane to San Francisco, so this is all being done in a slight hurry. But it doesn't matter, because another packed show today. We've got Nintendo Switch updates. We've got new games, including The Little Acre and an interview with the developers Peter Games and Charles Cecil, he of Broken Sword fame, who executive produced the game, plus information about the new South Park game that has hit, and Sega Forever. I'm not the only thing that's going to be lasting forever and contributing beyond the grave. Sega, dead alive.
It's still going somehow.
That's a bit harsh, isn't it? No. So they've got games, five new games from the Mega Drive come onto iOS, and I've played them all, and we'll work out whether that's a good thing or not.
It's not.
Oh! But first, some news. I haven't got a Nintendo Switch yet, but if I did get one, I would want to be able to make the controllers buzz remotely from another room and scare the people nearby.
Don't be ridiculous, James.
Well, who would even conceive of such a... Oh, Nintendo, you lovely people. You've just added it in the latest Switch update. 3.0.0. Another big three. Ooh. big old new update and a few useful things. So firstly, speaker volume has been boosted massively, which I've heard as a complaint from people. You said it was sort of on the quiet side.
Yeah, it was definitely a necessary upgrade because, like, even if you had it up at full volume, like if I'm on the train or something, have it up at full volume with my over-ear headphones, I can still hear the outside world.
Yep.
And ooh. I don't want to hear the outside world, man.
There's horrible things there.
The most damning experience I had was when I was playing Thumper on a coach and I just couldn't hear any of the sound cues. So I was like, okay, I literally can't play this. And I had my headphones maximum volume.
So it was like no point at that point.
Yep.
I've had to do that when you're at shows or something and people are trying to demo a rhythm action game at you and it's so loud and you can't hear anything. It does basically make it impossible.
Mm-hmm.
There's some stuff that maybe, you know, is not quite so important. So you get new Splatoon 2 icons, 6 of them. That's, care. Perhaps one of the weirdest ones, though, and I know we've got different opinions on this, you can change the display colours, basically inverting the screen colour palette or make it black and white.
Hey man, playing any Switch game in inverted colours is just the lead to nightmare fuel.
It's one of the early Photoshop filters they did. 90s television, whenever they put those small collection of effects that they've got. Because, you know, analogue effects. One of them was always invert, where everything kind of goes blue and purple and weird. Yeah. Why would you... Why, basically?
Because they're Nintendo, they can do what they want.
But who's going to play it inverted?
Yeah. I don't know.
Challenge?
You know what would probably have made sense? A colourblind mode.
Yes.
Yeah.
But no, Nintendo are using their resources on inverted colours.
Some games do have that, the old colourblind mode, which is obviously useful. Grayscale, I can get behind, sort of, because some things do work very, very well in black and white. There's been this trend with movies recently to do grayscale versions of them, like with Mad Max Fury Road and Logan.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you remove the colour palette, it focuses you on the shapes and the lines more so than anything else. But inverted always just looks just weird. Like in a movie, like an old bad movie, when they try and signify that someone's on LSD or something. That's what they do. They just invert the colour palette and it just looks stupid.
Yeah, to be fair, that's kind of what it is now. Maybe it's just Nintendo wants everyone to feel like they're on LSD all the time.
They do a pretty good job about that anyway. Have you seen Mario Odyssey.
Yeah, I was about to say.
That's some trippy stuff right there.
Oh, yeah.
There's also the usual system stability improvements that you'll be familiar with if you've ever had a PS4 update. Improved stability. Yay!
So thanks. Why wasn't it here to begin with?
But there's a full list of it all on the front page of PG, so you can go and have a look at that. Now, jumping straight over to iOS and Android, we've had Street Fighter games on mobile before, and Capcom has revealed the first trailer for Street Fighter 4 Championship Edition,
wow,
which is going to be coming to iPhone and iPad in early July. We've all watched the trailer by now. This is not a good idea at all.
No, not really, no. There was actually a new video that came out today.
Really?
Yeah, it was like a little bit of gameplay, but kind of like, you know, one of those game trailer-y kind of things where it shows two people playing it.
Yeah.
And it's like you said, it's floating joystick and buttons for controlling.
Ooh. Ooh. That's considering how much time people spend, like, making sure they've got the right controller for console, where even your average PS3 or 4 controller is deemed not good enough. So people go out and get the Hori sticks with the full 6 buttons and everything. It feels nasty on mobile. The old version felt kind of nasty on mobile. Like, who wants to play Street Fighter on a tiny wee touchscreen?
Yeah. Yeah, I get you.
Especially when it runs really bad.
It does appear to be running at about 12 frames a second, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's weird because they've just sort of like remastered Street Fighter 2 for Switch, and that would have seemed sort of a natural fit for mobile as well.
I was going to say it's a bit slower, but I'm not sure if it is. Maybe it is. I think it is a bit slower. The animations and everything. I'm sure that game runs slower. It gives you a little bit more leeway on mobile with the fact that controls are super twitchy, so you have to... Slower games tend to work best when they're ported over. Basically, strategy games and things like that work well. Anything that demands lightning-fast, split-second reflexes. When you're using a floating joystick and buttons with no physical feedback, I think our skepticism has been reflected in the YouTube downvotes, which have been plentiful.
Yes, it's almost as good as Rebecca Black's Friday.
Almost. Well, again, you can see the trailer up there on PG and make your own opinions. Maybe it's going to be great. This might be the best version of Street Fighter on any platform. We don't know. We haven't played it, but it won't be. So, something that does work well in a handheld format and has been proved for many years now is the DS, the Nintendo Dual Screen, as I believe its full name is. It's had many incarnations now, from 3DS to 3DS Lite to 3DS New, XL, all the different sizes, and finally, what appears to be the final installment in this little charade is the 2DS XL, new 2DS XL, which is out in the UK in about a month or so. However, Glenn, you've got one.
Yay.
And reviewed it.
Yep, gave it a gold award, didn't I?
Cool, blimey, lovely. Now, when you first went to preview it over at an event, you were a little bit like unsure about it because it does have a few notable differences. What turned you around? What are the good bits?
So what I was unsure about was Nintendo's marketing, because they basically claimed that this was designed to fill the gap between the 3DS XL and the 2DS, but we already had the 3DS. They were like, oh, this is aimed at kids, though. And I was like, yeah, but you had the cover plates and stuff on the 3DS, so that kind of felt like, you know, aimed at kids. And they're like, this is cheaper. And I was like, yeah, but for £30 extra, you can get a 3DS with 3D.
And you can have a Yoshi on the front of it.
That's
or something.
It. That's it. So they didn't like me at that point and threw me out. But I did eventually get my hands on one, and I decided, screw Nintendo's marketing. This is a good device. It's just marketed wrong. Like, it's basically the best iteration of the 3DS yet, from my perspective.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can understand why, because... A, the look is fantastic. It's got a lot more character than, for example, I've got the new 3DS XL, and it's just a big, really dark blue, shiny blob, you know? And this has got, it looks like a corrugated iron surface almost.
Yeah.
With the wee blue rim around it. The insides almost look like a mobile phone now. We pointed this out in the past where the screen has got a little layer of glass over the top of it. And the two colour schemes, we've only got the grey and blue one, but there's also that white and orange one, I think, as well.
Yeah.
But hardware-wise, the insides are the same, just without the 3D bit. So it runs all the same stuff as the new 3DS does. The only difference being there is no 3D. It's a bit cheaper. Your favourite feature of all of it, which always makes me smile, is it closes, doesn't it?
Yeah, properly this time. Like, there's no little gap letting in dust and, like, pocket fluff. It's just...
Spiders.
Snug. Yeah, and spiders, yeah. Because I never liked that. And I think it's mostly due to my OCD more than anything else. But on the original models, I used to just be like, why have they left this gap? It just looks so cheap and tacky. And like I've always really admired the DS Lite because it was just the perfect, like, gorgeous, nice rectangle, thin, closed thing. And it was lovely, and I liked it. And then they've brought that design back a bit. This is a lot chunkier than that was, but it's still principally the same, which is nice.
You've got the C-nub and all that stuff that was that was added to... I think they shuffled a couple of ports around, but nothing... They didn't remove anything.
No, it's just the same design largely as the new Nintendo 3DS XL. But they've moved a few things, like the home button has moved to the left of the screen rather than on the screen now. And it just makes... The screen isn't actually bigger, but it does look bigger, the touchscreen at the bottom. It's weird. It's the same size, and it hasn't got any weird bezels or anything. It's just a nice flat screen. They've moved the power button from the top panel, let's call it a panel, to the bottom panel, which is nice. And they have changed... this is a really big game changer here. So they've included a flap. Do you remember yesterday when we recorded this the first time, I said flap 1,000 times?
You did, yes. This is the second time we've taken her on at this podcast because the first one went screwy.
Yeah.
They've given her a flap beneath which sits an accessible micro SD.
Exactly. You don't have to break your system to get the SD card out now. It's
that
just
was a weird design choice with the 3DS XL.
Nintendo love their weird design choices, though. So basically that sits next to the game card slot under a flap, so your game's not going to pop out like it used to when it's in your pocket. So that's nice. And also, it's just nice to not being able to see the games because they're always a different color to your device. So I like that.
It all looks really smart. I've seen a lot of photos and videos, not held the thing. But had I not already got a new 3DS XL, I would probably be on this. And it's a bit cheaper. It's $129.99 at retail when it hits in the UK. Because like I say, it's not a month. It's a month till it comes out. So you'll have to bear with. But you can look at the pictures that Glenn took and lick the screen if you like.
Yep, definitely do that.
New 2DS XL out in a month. Point and click adventures have been a mainstay of gaming over the past, it's got to be 20 years, even 30 years now. And it's still alive and well, and that is also to be said for one of the latest point and click adventures, The Little Acre. I am delighted to be joined by not one but three people working on this game. I'm being joined by Christopher and Ben from Pewter.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, guys. And also by Charles Cecil. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello.
We'll start with a little introduction of the game itself. If you just give us a little rundown of what The Little Acre is all about.
So The Little Acre is a point-and-click adventure. The game itself, it centers on two main characters. So you've got Aiden and his daughter Lily, and his daughter is like 6 years old or so. The main kind of object of the game at the start is just to explore around the area, the house that they live in. And it soon becomes apparent that Aiden's father is missing. So when he goes looking for him, he just inadvertently, you know, transports himself to this fantasy universe. And then Lily goes through the same process of looking for her dad. And then she also gets transported. So suddenly they're both in this like fantasy universe. And then it's just about where that adventure takes them.
Yeah, it's inspired by those 80s escapist fantasy films, like the Neverending Story and Labyrinth. And, you know, you have a real world and a fantasy world, and they kind of jump back and forth between the two. But then I guess the big thing about this game is visually it's heavily inspired by the Don Bluth Disney era type of hand-drawn animation.
Don Bluth was exactly the reference I was going to ask about.
Thank
that's
God.
What it feels. It feels like that to me, that whole kind of, you know, Rats of Nim and all that vibe.
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah, exactly. And All Dogs Go to Heaven and those things. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's kind of another, you know, connection we had with Charles is that there's this animation studio in Dublin called Ballyfermot, or sorry, a college in Dublin called Ballyfermot, and they they were kind of pretty much set up to feed animators to Don Bluth, who were also set up in making those films in Dublin. So they they teach this classic animated style, you know, that kind of has slipped out of use because it's stupid to do and it's expensive, but it looks great.
But you know, do you not think it's interesting that it's absolutely specific to Don Bluth, and it doesn't look like Disney, it doesn't look like anything else. And at the very beginning, there's a mouse that comes up on a on the title screen, and it just moves like a Don Bluth mouse. It doesn't move like a Disney mouse. Many years ago, Edge did a piece on Ballyfermot, and I went over there, and I was lucky enough to meet a very talented layout artist called Owen Cahill, who looked at our work for Broken Sword before, well, at the very, very early stages, squealed with laughter and said, this is just not good enough. And he was absolutely right. And he then came to work for Revolution and was really responsible for a lot of the success of Broken Sword. So I owe him a great debt of gratitude. And it was just such a thrill to see the Little Acre and clearly with this Don Bluth experience. And it sort of felt like everything was going full circle when I was invited to get involved with the project, which I was very flattered when I was asked by these guys.
It's fair to say, then, it's sort of a game about different perspectives, isn't it? Because you take control of both characters, the older and the younger, and they react differently to the world that they're in, don't they?
Yeah, they very much definitely. Do. I think that was kind of one of my goals writing the dialogue for them, was to almost make them polar opposites. You know, Aiden is kind of apprehensive and he thinks everything out before doing it. Where Lily is just, she jumps headfirst into adventure. So I think that's one of the fun things is just seeing their different reactions, because, you know, there's certain areas that they both visit. They'll see some of the same things. They'll see some of the interact with some of the same objects. So seeing their very different reactions to the two, at least I think, is kind of funny.
One of the really great, charming things, of course, is when Lily, early in, is clearly a child who's both very naive but also full of self-confidence. And it's really beautiful that poor old Dougal, her dog, does the very best he can to keep her out of trouble. And again, the animation is absolutely beautiful when Dougal realizes that she's in some sort of jeopardy, rushes over and just saves the day. And Lily is absolutely oblivious to this. And it does feel like a really high-quality cartoon, but obviously as an interactive point-and-click adventure.
Charles, you are responsible in many ways for the 90s popularization of the point-and-click adventure, with very famously Broken Sword and other adventures as well. How did you come to be involved in this, you know, new incarnation of the genre here?
Chris sort of was slightly sheepish when I met him, and did point out that some of the inspiration had come from Broken Sword.
Can we say that legally? I'm not sure where we stand there.
I was hugely flattered that both some of their layouts and some of their animation and some of their dialogue pretty much directly referenced Broken Sword, which was great. And Curve actually approached me and said, these guys really enjoy Broken Sword and they feel that's an inspiration, and invited me to meet these guys. And as I say, it was a real privilege to be able to act as an executive producer. But I made it clear that if I was going to do this, what I didn't want to do was just sit there and do nothing. So I'm afraid I've been sort of banging backwards and forwards with suggestions and ideas. And I'm very flattered that a lot of them have been implemented, obviously not all of them. And guys, do you feel the game is better for it? I hope you're going to say yes.
No, absolutely.
Well, we have two versions. There's one of that.
Oh, really?
The one you sent me and the one that you publish.
Exactly, yeah. And the good one. It's been so much better because this was originally a college project and it was terrible because we had no artists, if you can imagine what this game could possibly look like without good art, you know, like it was terrible. So then, you know, we've been trudging away at this since we left college to try and get probably only 2 years of actually having a studio and making the game, but it'd been around for 4 years, probably something like that.
With the actual genre itself, I mean, we've seen a few of them appear recently, like in the mainstream, I mean they've always floated around in the background for the whole, like, you know, 20, 30 years they've been going, but with the kind of remastering of things like Full Throttle, with Wadget Eye Games continuing to make point and click adventures, why do you think that this comparably old style of game has managed to stay relevant to people?
It's kind of a mixture of the things that you were saying there, that some of the classics were coming back. So it was bringing that genre back into the focus of the mainstream audience. But also, I think, just a change in technology, you know, making it like what we're doing here, releasing it for iOS. I think they just work so great on touchscreen devices that I think that might be why they are kind of popular again. I think Charles might vouch for the fact that, you know, it was a great idea to even release the old Broken Sword ones on iOS and kind of give them a new lease of life. So I think that's probably a large reason for it. But
we were thrilled at the reception of Broken Sword because it was a new audience. The audience was actually a new audience. It was about split between young people coming in and discovering adventures for the first time and finding them utterly legitimate as a gameplay. And then maybe older people who are looking back and reminiscing. But the bigger market is the new market. So it's still an utterly contemporary genre. And as Chris says, it just works very, very well on touchscreens. I think one of the reasons that the adventure works particularly well is because cerebral gameplay and having cartoony graphics, the graphics are very clear. It's very clear what you can do, what you can't do, what you can interact with. And from that, you can determine the puzzles. And in many ways, that works better than 3D, which is one of the reasons why we, for Broken Sword 5, went back to 2D. But we didn't go back to the full 2D animation as they have done in The Little Acre. And that's really, really impressive. It's something that scared us, but it's something that these guys have embraced absolutely. And I believe it's because you had so much access to talent from Ballyfermot, wasn't it, guys?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's what, you know, all of the animators, that's what they learned. It's that traditional animation. So it was just natural to make use of that instead of getting them to really get to grips with, say, skeletal animation that you would see a lot, you know, with tweening type animation. And it is kind of more, you know, it's quicker, it's more efficient to do that type of animation, but it arguably, I mean, this is kind of an opinion, but it arguably doesn't look as good. So
I feel like it dates quite quickly. Early 3D animation, yeah. You kind of go, ooh, that looks a bit 1995 FMV.
Right, and it's the same way, I think, with some skeletal animation. If it's not done, you know, masterfully, then it can be a bit jarring. Whereas, you know, hand-drawn animation where the animators have control over every single frame, it just comes across a lot more natural and a lot more appealing.
We also gave them a lot more freedom, though, as well. Like, this wasn't an external contractor doing all the animations. It was everyone sitting around in the office together doing it. So, you know, we wouldn't give them too much instruction. We'd say, he needs to pick up a shovel, you know, and then the animator would just go away and do whatever way they wanted him to pick up that shovel. And I think that also added to the actual, how you empathize with the characters, I think, would almost increase, you know, just seeing how they happen to pick something up rather than a real obvious schedule, or, you know, bend, pick, put it back in, you know, typical animation, you know.
If you empower an animator who is really involved and excited and by the project, then they will come up with animations that you would never have expected in a million years. And that adds so much character and humor to the game. I think that's a really, really important point, because often these days you kind of micromanage. You have to micromanage, because if you're doing motion capture, then you have to define them in advance. You have to, you know, everybody's really clear. And what's lovely about what these guys have done is it's been much more freeform. I wouldn't use the word anarchy, but it's been very much freeform. So everybody can contribute in their own way, which is great. And it comes across in the game itself.
Well, there's an elasticity to that kind of freeform hand animation where you can sort of defy the rules of gravity and logic. Whereas if you're anchored to some kind of skeletal form that you just have to, you know, you can move the eyes open to a certain degree and then there's a limit on it. And it can be a bit restrictive and almost sort of robotic, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, you can see that in some of the more exaggerated animations where, you know, you would see what's called multiples, where, let's say, if something happens very quickly, you would see, you know, multiple frames at the same time of a hand swishing through the air to give the appearance of something moving very fast. And
that ghosting effect.
Exactly, yeah. And something that you would see in the old school cartoons that just looks really great that we were able to get across.
During production, we actually had a wall of shame of the worst looking smears of characters, you know, that actually are in the game and look great in motion, but look like horrific demons from hell.
Yeah,
well, I'm really glad to see that this kind of storytelling and these type of adventure games remain alive, because I was an Amiga owner back in the day and a big fan of all this kind of stuff. What do you guys all feel about the rise of a company like Telltale, which for me seems to be kind of a riff on that formula, almost paring it down to its very barest essentials and making it even more accessible, perhaps, than some of the more complicated point-and-clicks. But it still feels like it's very much the modern interpretation of the point-and-click adventure.
Yeah. I mean, I do have to say, I do really enjoy those games. I think what they've kind of done is, like you said, they've boiled it down, and it's you know, it's become their business. It's not quite formulaic, but there is a formula to it. And it just works. The only thing I would be concerned about is, you know, I've heard people talk about Telltale fatigue, and that's just because it's applying the exact same rules to every single game, which I think for every game that we make, we're going to just look at each one as a unique thing and do whatever needs to be done for that one.
I think what Telltale are doing just really shows how broad the genre is as a whole, the adventure genre. And, you know, if you look at one extreme, you do have Telltale, which are hugely popular, very, very little gameplay challenge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unashamedly very little gameplay challenge. At the other end, you probably have point-and-click adventures, but then you also have games that are clearly adventures, like Life is Strange, like Her Story. A wonderful, wonderful range of games within this genre. So I think as a genre, it's healthier than it ever has been. And clearly from a commercial perspective, there's still an awful lot of demand and a lot of love for the point-and-click adventure games. But I think we can be very proud that the genre as a whole is as broad and as popular as it is.
Yeah, I think Telltale was actually quite useful for us when we brought the game to PAX or to, you know, some of the other events that we at Gamescom. It's a lot of the kind of teenagers who might not know, if you said point-and-click adventure, have you ever played them before? They'd say no, and what is that? But as soon as we'd say, well, have you played Walking Dead Telltale? You know, and they're like, oh, yeah, I know exactly. And then they kind of understood what this game was going to entail, even though it's nothing like it, but they're like, oh, it's a thing about stories and characters and using items, you know.
Yeah, or even if you did say, have you ever played an adventure game, they'd say, oh, you mean like Telltale games, and you know, it's not quite what you intended, but at least it is some sort of point of reference for them, so you can see that they have done well in bringing it to the modern audience.
And when it comes to bringing these games to touchscreens, we were all obviously delighted when they appeared, being mobile-focused as we are. I played through Broken Sword again on an Android device I had at the time when it first came out. And we've always said that there are certain genres that do seem to fit touchscreen devices incredibly well. So strategy games can often work well by just pointing at troops and selecting them and dragging them. And point-and-click adventures are another example of that one, that it seems to fit. Are there any challenges behind the scenes in making these ones work on, for example, smaller screens than they used to be played on?
Yeah, I mean, we had to scale our UI completely differently, you know, based on the range of devices. Well, I mean, luckily we're going with iOS for the first thing anyway. So, you know, there's at least some standards there in terms of screens and things like that. But there's been a lot of UI work. And actually, Charles, again, was quite helpful there because we went with a sort of a classic using an item system for the PC one, using a mouse. So you click it and then your cursor becomes that. Whereas you might notice other games, I think Broken Age would have more of a drag and drop even on the PC version, which they were obviously thinking about probably going to mobile and adding a sort of a drag and drop system that early on. So for us, we didn't have that. So then we had to kind of come up with a more unique way to show that you have currently selected this item. And Charles was pretty helpful there getting we have like an animated UI item kind of bobbing back and forth that lets you know what you have on your finger.
I thought your system was great. I have to say, I think it was better than ours, to be honest. so I'll accept those compliments with great gratitude. but I think it works. I think actually you guys have been able to keep honing. I mean, one of the things that was interesting when we first did Broken Sword is that we were very lucky because we'd written the DS version, which of course was touchscreen using
stylus.
Thank you. Sorry for forgetting the word there. A stylus. And our big competition was LucasArts, of course, and Monkey Island. And when the games came out very close to each other, it was clear that we'd focused on the UI, the user interface, while they'd focused on the graphics. And I think we made the right choice. And it's really interesting then now to play the most contemporary adventure games and to see how the UI has developed further.
And with this game now in the bag and being released on iOS, what is it that you're going to be working on next? Will this Trio partnership continue? Do you have something else in the pipeline?
That's the question, isn't it? I mean, we're gonna keep going with this for a little while. We'll probably look at releasing other platforms like Android and stuff. We definitely love to work with Charles again in the future. There's not exactly any plans on that, like concrete or anything like that yet, but like definitely we'd be open to it at some point.
Absolutely, likewise. And I feel that actually the very best is the energy of young developers like these guys. You know, somebody offering a little bit of advice, having done it many times, hopefully to give positive suggestions and then also to make sure that they don't fall into the traps that are so easy that we all know about, that, you know, those of us who've been doing it for a few years.
I say one thing for sure is that we're going to keep our art style, you know, the hand-drawn animation thing. That's just, it was so useful, again, at conventions to kind of grab people's attention and you can just tell the love and care that all the artists put into it. So no matter what, that art style is definitely something that we hope is like indicative of our computer game studios from this point moving on, you know.
Well, thank you ever so much for joining me today, guys, and best of luck with the next project.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Lovely.
Out and about this week. This is kind of a big news thing as well as a new release thing, but we'll bundle it into one. Sega Forever, the new Sega initiative, which is basically about bringing old games from the Sega back catalogue, from the Mega Drive, Master System, even Dreamcast era, onto iPhones and iPads in free-to-play form. We had 5 games go live this week. Altered Beast, Comic Zone, Kid Chameleon, Sonic the Hedgehog, and Phantasy Star 2. We've played them. By we, I certainly mean me and Glenn. I don't know about you, Em. No, she's spat on them from afar. Glenn and I have played them. I've done a video of it, which is up on OutSpy right now. You can see me playing through all 5 in one go, just to give you a feel for what it's all about. Now, mixed results, I think, would be fair to say.
It's fair, yeah.
Starting with Sonic the Hedgehog, that's been on iOS and Android for ages.
Yeah, it has, yeah.
In various formats. You've had Sonic CD, you had the original Sonic, and that guy who did a port of it, something Whitehead, and made a fairly decent version of it. Yes, it's got floaty touch controls, but it does work. You can control it just about. The model seems to be the same across all 5 of the games, which is that free-to-play at the point of purchase, you can pick it up for free, then they'll play adverts in between levels, like where loading screens would be.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to do it every time either. So I've played through some of the games. I didn't hit an advert for like maybe 3 or 4 loading screens. They never pop up during gameplay. So you don't get any of this nasty like overlaid ads at the bottom of the screen. And you don't get anything that interrupts you mid-special move or anything. I've actually found it quite non-intrusive as far as it goes. They play for about 5 seconds and you can kill them if you want to. And just crack on. So that element of it, I think, has been introduced very fairly. You can buy the games if you want for £1.99 or $1.99, and then no ads, you've just got the game sorted, and that applies across all 5 of them. As far as the actual controls of these games go, I think this is where it starts to get a bit less positive.
Yeah.
Which one do you think handled best, and which one do you think handled worst, Glenn?
Okay, so I think I'd probably say that Sonic, for me, handled best. Because it didn't... I mean, I think it's based on that original port, isn't it? The decent one. Yeah, so that one was pretty decent. I didn't really experience many issues. I've read that people have had, like, slowdown and stuff, but I didn't have any of that. So it seemed okay to me. Can't really think... What do you think handled the worst?
Well, unfortunately, Comic Zone doesn't handle very well for me because it looks incredible. It's like a beautiful moving comic thing. Like I said in the video, but think framed, only really, really violent and brightly coloured. The problem is the other 4 games have been essentially packaged in a wrapper. It feels like it's basically an emulator. Sega's released an emulator and each of the games is packaged in this emulator. It's in 4x3, so you've got the bars at the side of the screen, and then overlaid over the top of it is the classic Sega control system. So you've got that Sega D-pad in the lower left, and you've got the ABC buttons in the lower right. Just like with the original Mega Drive or Genesis, if you're in the States, controller. Problem is, it's small and... Oh, with Comic Zone, if you move left or right, your character walks left or right. If you go, say, top left or bottom left, your character prepares to do a kick, like it stops and does a wee, he goes into a stance, basically. And the difference between going left and going upper left is about 0.5 nanometer of screen space. So yeah. I was just constantly trying to walk left and the character would just stop and twitch up and go, ooh, knee grab, and then you have to try and roll my thumb ever so slightly down so it will walk again. And that stuff, that feels like, without any physical feedback, without a nice big D-pad under my finger, not one that my thumb completely covers,
yeah,
it doesn't feel very comfortable on touchscreen.
No, I've always felt like with ports of console games, it always kind of feels like they're forced onto mobile rather than a comfortable fit.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But it's not the only problem I have with Sega Forever. Like, you know, the games, they run generally fine. They're, you know, there's room for improvement. The virtual controls are a big issue. But I think what bothered me the most was kind of like the uninspiring launch lineup. Like, these are Mega Drive games we've either seen on mobile before or, you know, have been on like thousands of different consoles and mini consoles, like you know, over the past. It would have been nice to see something like Skies of Arcadia, something that was really going to make us go, oh wow, Sega are taking this seriously.
Hmm. Well, I think they have some like name recognition. So of the lineup, apart from Sonic, Kid Chameleon and Altered Beast, like I'm old enough to remember these games first time around, and my brother had a Mega Drive, older brother, and I did go, ooh, Kid Chameleon, Altered Beast, yay. And then I played them and went, oh, wait, Altered Beast's not even that good. like the first time around, Altered Beast wasn't that good. It's really clunky and slow, and there were much better platformers out there. But it had a big, like, Wolfman on the cover, so people thought it would be wicked.
Yeah.
It's got one of those rock metal album covers that look much That's more true. Impressive than the thing inside it. Kid Chameleon as well, that I won't be revisiting that again. It's very lackluster as a platformer. It hasn't aged particularly well, I don't think. The one that really looked great still was Comic Zone. And then Phantasy Star 2 is a top-down RPG. I think people are more familiar maybe with, certainly in the West, with Phantasy Star Online from the Dreamcast era.
That's the one I played.
Yeah, that's the one everyone I know played. But Phantasy Star 2, I mean, I haven't played through it or anything. I just played the first 10 minutes and it's like, well, it's a standard top-down JRPG.
Mm-hmm.
Those work fine on mobile, but I know what you mean. I mean, I guess that they are putting the toe in the water with this. Going, here's a few games, see what you think. And in the background, they're working on some of the things that I think will make people go, ooh, I want to have a go on this one.
Yeah, I mean, they've claimed that they're going to bring games from every single console era, you know, Sega consoles. So there's chances we're going to see something exciting, but I just think the launch lineup's very, just meh. I just don't really care. That's my general feeling towards Sega Forever, based on what I've seen so far. Like, it feels like Sega making a really big fuss about re-releasing games they've re-released 1,000 times before.
Hmm. Hang on, we're getting into Nintendo territory here, aren't we?
A little bit, yeah.
Sega are stealing their bit. I don't know if you had an interest in Sega stuff, but like, if you weren't a Mega Drive owner first time around, Em, like, do you look at this and go, "Oh, I'd like to take a look at that and see how it all handled," or are you put off by the fact that it's on mobile instead of giving you a controller and letting you play on the original console?
I appreciate the idea of it. Because it is a good idea to bring some of those games back, you know, for it to be free. And like you said, the advertising is very good on it. But I would prefer just to play it with a controller on the console, personally.
Mm. And we should say that all the games, apparently, though I haven't tested it, have MFI controller support.
Mm.
So you can use a Bluetooth controller and play it that way. So, you know, that's a good thing.
And if you have Apple TV as well, apparently a lot of them work there as well. So if you have a controller on Apple TV, you're kind of getting a, like, legit Sega Mega Drive.
Oh, nice. Yeah, see, that's good. I see it more as a time capsule thing. It's a way for people who may never have seen the stuff to have a look at it and go, oh, this is what games used to look like, not necessarily feel like. And then if they're inspired by any of it, they can go, well, maybe I'll try and find a Mega Drive on eBay or something like that and play it properly. I don't think they are, by any definition, the definitive version of these games.
No.
So as long as you go in with that mindset, just have a little look and say, oh, isn't the past funny? But you can get all five of those games on iPhone and Android for free at the moment. Now, we just talked to the developers of The Little Acre. Emily, you have reviewed it. We covered a lot of it in the interview, but point-and-click adventure, charming, sun, fancy worlds, all that business. How does it hold up? And have you been able to complete any of it with that bug?
Long and short, no.
Ah.
No, it was a good adventure. Like, I was emailing back and forth yesterday just to let them know that I put the review up and stuff because it is live now. And at the moment, I haven't scored it because it's not fair for me to give an opinion on something that I haven't properly seen.
Mm.
But from what I've seen so far, like, I played about 45 minutes of it before the bug sort of kicked in and then kicked me out. And it's very charming. Like, the music is lovely. The voice acting is very good. The script is a little stiff, but...
Mm-hmm.
The visuals and the animation are really, really lovely. And I think where a lot of people, like, if you see the Steam reviews and stuff, they're all very kind of hit and miss because it's a very short game. And I think they're charging about a tenner for it on Steam, whilst on mobile, at the moment, they're only charging £2.99 for it, which is much more reasonable.
Wow, okay, I didn't realise there was such a big difference.
Yeah, but it might be an introductory price thing because it's just, like, come out, you know, how they do the launch week sale.
Sure,
so
sure.
That, for me, kind of puts it more into a worthwhile territory. I wouldn't pay £10 for it because it is so short. But you can see all the effort that's gone in and the fact that the developers are very passionate about it, and it's just nice. I personally enjoyed it, and I will go back to it obviously to finish my review.
And you like point-and-click adventures anyway. We were talking about the genre in relation to Telltale, and of which you are another big fan.
Yeah, I'm awful, aren't I? It's like everyone else is just awful. Like, Glenn does MMOs and, you know, the fighting stuff, and then it's just me is like, oh, I like pointing and clicking around a screen.
But I think it's because you focus on narrative. You're drawn, like I am, by story. You want to engage with characters rather than just necessarily shoot everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't get on with the game if there's not at least, like, an inkling of story in there. Because I'm very, very hungry for it. Like, it's what kind of drives me. Because I feel like where I am in my own business, like, obviously, I write and I play games and things like that. I have no time of the day to do anything. So if I'm going to spend time playing a game, it's got to be worthwhile.
You want the emotional investment.
Yeah, exactly. Unless I'm playing, actually, you know, the one exception is when I'm playing with other people. Like, I've got my regular group of gamers that I play with, like, every other night. And none of the stuff we play has a story to it, and that's perfectly fine. Like, we shoot stuff and we play golf and tabletop sims and all that sort of stuff.
We make your own stories in multiplayer games. That's the cliche, isn't it?
Well, exactly. True. You just laugh with each other and be like, you're crap at this game.
I'm not playing with you. You sound mean.
I am mean. But no, it's usually me that's failing, to be fair.
Gotcha. Be wary if you're going onto iOS. They've been alerted, like Em says. We've informed them directly, so they're looking into it. Maybe hold fire till they've sorted out those issues. Now, Colin Lane, we interviewed him a couple of weeks back. He of the Wrestling and Golf Zero and all those other crazy physics games. He's come out with another one. It's themed around American football called Touchdowners. You take control of three American footballers at once. The aim is to try and grab the ball, get it in the end zone, and fight against three other American footballers. However, when you move around, it's not running up and down Madden-style quality animation. It's very, very 2D, arms flailing around in all directions. They're almost being propelled forward by their helicoptering arms. And if you've ever played any one of Colin Lane's games, you'll be familiar with this physics nightmare. Lots of fun, very, very crazy, very, very anarchic. You don't have direct control in a real way. It's just sort of you're almost willing the characters towards the end zone. And every time you touch someone else, the ball just immediately swaps possession. So it's chaotic and daft, but it's also a lot of fun. We gave it 9 out of 10. Harry really loved it, and we're fans of his and his oeuvre, and it's a good entry in it. So we'd suggest going and having a look at Touchdowners. I'll mention this is only a soft launch thing, but and I know you guys haven't played it yet, but if you're in Sweden, Finland, Denmark, or Norway, you can get South Park Phone Destroyer, which is their version of a tower offense game, I guess. It's a bit Clash Royale, and a little bit Card Battler Hearthstone-y as well. It looks very much the part, exactly like those South Park games, Stick of Truth and the upcoming Fractured But Whole, and it is actually quite good to play. The art on the cards is really nice in that way that Magic the Gathering cards are really beautifully drawn. They've done the same thing, only it's like tweak in a red Indian outfit and stuff, so it looks kind of quite cool. But at the same time, I was raised a slight eyebrow because South Park did dedicate an entire episode to ripping on free-to-play games on mobile, and now they've released their own free-to-play mobile game. But you can get that if you're in one of those countries I mentioned, South Park Phone Destroyer. Very quickly, we also covered the release of The Mummy Dark Universe Stories. Just trips off the tongue, doesn't it? But this is the game set to accompany the really badly received movie with Tom Cruise, but it's by Night School Studios, who were very good, and the game actually sits somewhere in between. Apparently it's about 7 out of 10. It's lots of narrative, some voice acting, but mostly like an interactive storybook, but it seems to be much better than the film is. So if you're interested in that, maybe take a look at it rather than going to see the movie. We've also got a bunch of other new releases. So Panthera Frontier, which is out on iOS, which is clearly lifting FTL. So it's a top-down view of the ship. It's a little bit more cartoony than FTL, but it's a survival game. Maintain the systems, manage the crew members, yada, yada, yada. It's FTL, basically. And if it's better than that, I will be very surprised indeed. We've also got Star Scepter, which is an old-school shmup, which looks shmuppy. I haven't played it, but, you know, we're familiar with the gig by now. And Race Kings, which is the guys who gave us Smash Cops, which was Hutch Games, which is actually quite good. And this is a bit CSR, so it's got that drifting drag racy style game, but you're drifting rather than changing gears. That's kind of where they've put the emphasis on it. Race Kings is the name of that one. That's about it for this week. Lots to get on with, I suppose, with the Sega Forever, if you want to have a look. But if you've listened to us for 400 episodes,
congratulations.
Why? Glenn's just turned into a mad robot, so I will relay that he says goodbye. The recording's gone weird again. But do join us, not next week, because I'm going to be out in LA doing Pocket Gamer Connect stuff. So if you're in, not LA, San Francisco. Sorry. I'm going to fly to the wrong bit of California. And walk into the sea. But we'll see you the week after next. So bear with us during the outage, but I'll be back with lots and lots of new game chatter. And we look forward to seeing you then. And thank you for listening.
Bye.
Say bye in Robot Glenn.
Bye.